This is tape 10 of Goblinhood Satyricon. Copyright 1995 by James Beatty. Read by Goblinhood. This tape commences somewhere in the wilds of part 2. As a matter of fact, it's right in the middle of Goblinhood's little article about cannibalism in the local paper, where he compares Lovecraft and Heinlein, or whatever it is he's doing. So let's go on. In the end, he reveals himself as an agent for the Marson Old Ones, and eventually gets fully grokked, as he calls it, by his followers. The religious implications should be obvious. The Marson cannibalism was originally a survivalist extremity, and Smith himself, though highly charismatic and personable, was a raving psychotic by almost anyone's standards. Anyone human, that is. The book was said to have heavily influenced the Manson family cult of the 1960s, though Manson himself has since claimed never even to have read it. Heinlein, as it happens, is one of those authors, like H.P. Lovecraft, whose work I can often enjoy in spite of his often ugly right-wing politics. He often pokes great fun at Christianity. One of his last and best novels, Job, a comedy of justice, circa 1984, not only castigates Christianity, but seems to celebrate Satanism. In Stranger in a Strange Land, Heinlein reminds us gleefully of the biblical story of Lot in Sodom, who won favor with God by offering his own virgin daughters to a mob of rapists and sodomites to protect the virgin sphincters of two male guests who turned out to be angels. For more info, see Genesis 19, verse 8. Meanwhile, few are aware that Stranger in a Strange Land is actually, or seems to be at least, an interesting satire of Lovecraftian fantasy. Some of my readers won't understand what I'm talking about, but any good Lovecraft scholar should be able to see how Smith, the archetypical Superman and Marson intelligence agent, can be related to the quasi-humanoid being Nyarlathotep, messenger of Lovecraft's Old Ones, or Ancient Ones, recently linked to Mars through the entity known as Nurgle in the Necronomicon. Heinlein, a real clown when he wanted to be, almost as good as admitted to this satire in chapter 34 of The Number of the Beast. In that chapter, a character admits to reading Lovecraft and discusses the worlds of the Necronomicon. Four lines later, another character mentions Heinlein's own Stranger in a Strange Land, characterizing it as something trashy done for money. It was flimsy evidence at best, but then few of Goblinhood's readers really gave a damn about Heinlein or about Lovecraft. Besides, Goblinhood's only motive in seeking to prove a connection between the writings of the two authors was to validate the existence of his L'Envoi painting, which most of his readership had never even seen. Like most of the Gob's activities, this was all a study in futility, a morass of mind-numbing and pointless labor designed to accomplish ends which made little sense even to him. the L'Envoi painting had also equated goblinhood with both Nyarlathotep and with Smith. All the inflatable Maya dolls were supposed to approximate Smith's Martian hedonism. The whole thing, in its 1992 heyday, had been an effort towards scaring the electorate into voting goblinhood into the White House, though he didn't really want the job and campaigned this way only because he thought it was expected of him, an effort which the gob ultimately abandoned in order to prevent war being declared on the Martian provisional government, which very few or none of the electorate realized was simply another name for the Renegade Club. The L'Envoi painting also made substantial references to Christianity, mostly by quoting Heinlein on the subject. But even Lovecraft's masterpieces, The Dunwich Horror and The Call of Cthulhu, smacked of satire when viewed in association with the Christian mythos. The Dunwich Horror could even be said to satirize the long-abandoned and little-known heresy of the two Christs, for anybody who wanted to waste their time making irrelevant connections of this sort. Consequently, goblinhood had once, quite objectively, rated his own mythos for harmlessness in comparison to the other three, and had come up with this configuration. 1. Most harmless, the goblinhood mythos. 2. Relatively harmless, the Lovecraft mythos. 3. Not very harmless, Heinlein's Martians. 4. Totally malignant, Christianity. Here's how it broke down. Goblinhood, whose Martians were probably only delusional and whose only desire as president would have been to abdicate, had only threatened to destroy the world, sort of as a joke. He wasn't called more fun than your marrow being full of donkeys for nothing, you know. Lovecraft's monster gods, though scary enough, usually went away when some doddering librarian or somebody told them to, or, like Cthulhu, simply buggered off for no apparent reason at all. Heinlein's Martian old ones were genocidal on a planetary scale, but they took so long about it that they might as well have been doddering librarians or something. But the Christian mythos wallows in spooky violence and ends with the world being destroyed by its creator, the violent Christian God. By this point in Goblinhood's long and rambling monologue, the bored Shogun Squirrel had long since fallen asleep, but G.H. continued his reminisce for Pinkovsky's attentive benefit. The joke was, said G.H., that I couldn't destroy the world anyway because of the Martian sigil, at least not without corrupting and undermining the sigil, which was the only thing protecting me from the wrath of Mars. That had been how I kept Nurgle from using my psionic powers against the world before, by forcing the powers to be harmless with that mystic sigil, and that's what made Nurgle finally go away for good. Mescaline now eyed the gob in a speculative fashion. Are you quite sure that he's gone away? Apart from being a remarkably short sentence for her, that sounded like another paraphrase from Heinlein's L'Envoi chapter, which had also sort of included the further adventures of Smith. But the thought chilled the gob. What if all of this the whole setup here in Sodom was simply an illusion created by the Marson Zoni. What if the harmlessness breakdown represented an attack by Nurgle against the geish imposed by the sigil itself? What if all this really was leading up to some sort of apocalypse? What if Pinkovsky himself were an interplanetary agent for Nurgle or even for I-Corps, trying to break down the Gob's resistance? What if the Black Widows were just a big wet dream? What if the Shogun Squirrel wasn't really harmless after all? "Let's get out of here," muttered the Gob, needing some time alone to think. The case of the high stakes, or trouble in paradise, a Shogun Squirrel mystery. Goblin Hood sat on his balcony with his feet on the terrace, watching the sunset and thinking about the concept of harmlessness and about how it affected or seemed to affect events here in Sodom. Take hanging, for instance. The Gob thought about the sexual implications of that, and about the people who did it for kicks, and decided that, like everything else around here, when things were working right around here, the possibility of it was entirely dependent upon consensual choice. Suddenly, a black widow named Mandragora came out onto the balcony. She was mildly precognitive, and now she announced with a smirk, "The Shogun Squirrel's about to show up here acting like Sam Spade or something." They both laughed. "Send the little buffoon out here when it arrives," snickered the Gob, pinching one of the fleshy cheeks of Mandragora's succulent ass. She patted his head and left. Before long, the Shogun Squirrel, the best detective in town, was sitting on a little table on Goblin Hood's balcony, wearing a trench coat with its hat pulled down over its eyes, rolling its own cigarettes and nursing a fifth of bourbon through a straw. "What's this all about?" inquired the Gob, trying to keep a straight face.
"Did you write this?"
snapped the Shogun Squirrel, slapping down an old issue of The Spider Web with the air of somebody slapping an adversary across the face with a dead fish. The paper was folded to the Gob's Profiles in Carnage column as follows: occult Nazi snuff porn. According to a televised Geraldo Rivera special on the Satanist scene circa 1988, many highly placed right-wingers are Satanists, or vice versa. Many sources place Hitler in various occult societies, such as the Vril Power cultists, I believe, and the Thule societies. Society. Note to Lovecraftians. Thulu is one way to pronounce Cthulhu, okay? Anyway, I stumbled across an amazing reference to Nazi occult culture, which I just can't believe. Yet the source seems fully credible to me. Most of my research credits will follow this article, but this one I'm printing here in full because I'm quoting it in full. Quote, Hans Heinz Ewers went on to achieve considerable fame as an author. Apparently, in World War II, every German soldier was issued with a copy of the novel Auron. Ewers also wrote the Horst Wessel song for the Nazis, unquote. This statement was made on page 77 of the Film Encyclopedia Science Fiction, edited by Phil Hardy, published by William Morrow and Company, Inc., New York, 1984. The statement was made during a review of the 1928 film version of Auron, starring Paul Wegener of Gollum fame and the incomparable Bridget Helm, who played both Marias in the Fritz Lang classic Metropolis. Auron, which was filmed several times, is an occult story based upon the legend of the Mandrake, or Mandragora. This legend concerns the power of the Mandrake root, the humanoid-shaped root said to grow from the semen of hanged men. It grows under the gallows and is smothered in lore. Ewers has a scientist, Wegener, in the 28th film, collecting said semen and artificially inseminating a prostitute with it. The result is a daughter named Auron, played by Helm, Ibid, without a soul. If all this sounds a little too Frankensteinian, even for the Nazis, let's not forget the crackpot experiments of Joseph Mengele, Uncle Pepe to the kids, who tried to create artificial Aryans by injecting blue dye into his victims' eyes. Meanwhile, you won't know quite how weird the idea of Nazi soldiers carrying that book around is, unless I fill you in on certain accessory matters concerning the Nazi mentality and some of the strange practices that it led to, and more to the point, concerning hanging itself. So all this can be looked upon as an educational sleaze flash. In the first place, you have to understand that for some people, hanging has immense sexual connotations. William Burroughs goes into this in books like Naked Lunch and Cities of the Red Night. So do Robert Anton Wilson and Robert Shea in their trilogy Illuminatus. A favorite source of mine, The Mysteries of Life and Death, edited by Professor Keith Simpson and others, Salamander Books, 1979, not only discusses this, but even provides photographs of people who apparently died attempting to achieve orgasm by half-suffocating or strangling themselves. That book also talks about the two kinds of hanging. The first, preferred method, is a simple, quick death. When a hanging is done right, the victim's neck breaks and that's it. Death follows immediately. The second way to do it is a form of slow torture that can take up to 20 minutes or longer to result in death. The difference has to do with the kind of noose and its position, the length of drop involved, and so on. As near as I can tell from varied reading, certain other phenomena can occur during either kind of hanging. One of these is the basis of the Mandrake legend. Supposedly, with the neck, when the neck finally snaps or whatever, or perhaps due to the asphyxiation involved, hanging causes a man's body to be involuntarily ejaculate semen. In many, most, or all cases, the victim's sphincter muscle supposedly lets go as well. I haven't heard whether or not any of this is accompanied by actual orgasm in the cerebral sense. I suppose that the hanged man doesn't know whether he's coming or going. But being hanged then supposedly leads more or less automatically to creaming your jeans and to shitting your pants. It must be quite a spectacle, especially if you're not wearing any pants. The Nazis loved to hang people slowly. Hanging was a special punishment and a spectator sport in places like Auschwitz and Dachau. The 1944 July conspirators against Hitler were ordered by him to be hung like cattle and without mercy, which meant slow hanging. At their People's Court show trial, the defendants, already tortured in Gestapo cellars, were also deprived of articles like dentures and belts to further humiliate them. They had to spend the trial holding up their pants. Then on August 8, they were hung slowly from meat hooks by the SS. One source states that piano wire was used to hang them, but another specifies leather straps, which would have killed them less quickly. Every time the victims lost consciousness, they were revived so that the fun could go on and on. They still didn't have belts, so during the course of the long and torturous event, all their pants fell down. Though so far, no source has stated whether the dying conspirators squirted sperm cells or oozed excrement from their agonized carcasses. But this we do know. The execution was filmed, though the film didn't survive the war, and the results were rushed to Hitler's bunker, probably so that he could watch it while jacking off all over his mistress, Eva Braun. The film was so horrible that crusty old Nazi propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels is said to have had to cover his eyes to avoid fainting when he watched it. A closet wimp, I guess. He's also said to have had to hastily withdraw an edited version of it after trying to make certain selected army audiences watch it as an object lesson. At the cadet school in Lichterfeld, the proposed audience walked out. Doubtless, the army by this time was beginning to see the implied threat in their government-issued copies of All Wrong. Ironically, according to many sources, the gallows at Nuremberg was built improperly or something, so that the hangings were, in some ways, bungled. Some of the top Nazi leaders were said to have taken up to 24 minutes to die. But at least they got to keep their pants on, I think. One final note on Hitler's sex life. The best speculation that I've found yet is from the book Hitler's Hang-Ups by Mina C. and Arthur C. Klein, E.P. Dutton and Company, 1976. In this scholarly tome, the Nazi Führer, alleged by Soviet physicians to have been born with only one testicle, according to various sources, is described as having had an extreme distaste for body odors, dirt, sweat, excrement, blood, human suffering, the sight of wounded soldiers, and so on, unless such sights were filtered through the medium of film, one would have to suppose here. I've never heard, for instance, that Hitler ever visited the death camp at Auschwitz, nicknamed Anus Mundi, or Asshole of the World, by Nazi Captain Thilo, a visiting doctor of troops, in September of 1942. And certainly, by any account, no place for the squeamish. Yet, according to the best information that I can scrounge up, the Klein book, the way that Hitler actually got his rocks off, or his rock, goes beyond perverse and right into bizarre and incomprehensible. He was said, this hater of bad smells and bodily functions, to have been a devotee of what are known as golden showers, and even brown showers. Excuse me, I mean brown showers. But I guess you get the drift here. Go figure, huh? Clinical footnotes. Dissociation. 3. A defect of mental integration in which one or more groups of mental processes become separated off from normal consciousness and, thus separated, function as a unitary whole. Cf. Unconscious. Page 466, Dorland's Illustrated Medical Dictionary, 25th edition, C. 1974, copyright 1974 by W.B. Saunders Company. Algolagnia, abnormal sexual impulse toward persons of opposite sex, with a desire for experiencing or causing pain. Active A, sadism. Passive A, masochism. Page 55, Ibid. The article was followed by a long list of reference materials. Hopefully most of it was more dependable than the source for the Horst Wessel story. Günter Grass states in Notes to Dog Years that Horst Wessel wrote the Horst Wessel song. But again, most of the gob's readers didn't give a rat's ass. They only read his articles for their sick entertainment value, and considered the articles to be even funnier if the gob didn't know what the fuck he was talking about, as was often the case. Anyway, Goblin Hood scanned the article and its lurid illustrations. "Yeah, I wrote this," he informed the Shogun Squirrel. "So what?" The squirrel, annoyed, sucked loudly from the straw and bellowed,
"Look, you big fat ass, I don't give a damn how many fake pricks you think you can sit on. Put me down, goddamn you!"
Picking the Shogun Squirrel up by its pointed little ears was a complicated maneuver, necessitating the psionic growth of the ears to near rabbit size. Goblin Hood thoughtfully made the extra ear tissue, temporary as it was, insensitive to pain, in effect merely levitating the grumpy little Scurrius vulgaris, or whatever the animal was. Even so, G.H. had sort of broken his own harmlessness rule when he picked the squirrel up, harming its bloated ego anyway. But then the diminutive master detective frequently brought that out in people, and the harmlessness geish, straining already to preside over the whole of Sodom, apparently couldn't be bothered with an event so insignificant as this. "Listen, pipsqueak," began the gob, but the Shogun Squirrel pulled a tiny gat from its diminutive shoulder holster and lovingly squeezed off a few rounds. Fortunately, the tiny bullets bounced harmlessly off of Goblin Hood's chest. He was wearing a bulletproof leotard under his clothes, of course. Look, Squirt, continued the gob, I've about had your act. I don't know what you want here, but if you can't at least keep a civil tongue in your head, then get the fuck out.
Okay, okay,
grumbled the squirrel.
So put me down already.
Promise not to try any more weird judo holds or anything on me. This John Wayne routine of yours is getting really old. The Shogun squirrel, unexpectedly, started to cry.
You guys are always making fun of me,
blubbered the rodent.
Just because I'm small,
it began bawling hysterically. G.H. put the little twerp down, regretting all his badinage toward it at once. The squirrel sobbed as if its little heart would break. Actually, we make fun of you because you're so bellicose, explained the gob. But we're only kidding. I guess it must be tough, having a tough guy reputation like yours to have to live up to. Here, want a hanky?
Shove it,
sniffled the squirrel, stomping as hard as it could on the area where the gob's balls were located. The gob doubled over in sickening, agonizing pain.
I'll tell you what I want,
snarled the tear-streaked rodent, shoving its gun right into the gob's face where there was no bulletproof leotard.
I want to know, what's the big idea of picking me up by my ears, you big shit-ass? And it better be good.
The squirrel was back in top form now, Mickey spillaning it all the way. Goblinhood didn't think that the squirrel could actually blow his brains out and still be harmless, not even with such a small gun. But his throbbing cojones argued the possible existence of a singularity field here. In any case, he decided to be diplomatic with the scruffy little beast. Look, he gasped. I was just trying to help you save face, like in Red Harvest, you know? I figured that after Mescaline picked you up by your tail the other day, you'd feel better if a guy like me picked you up by your ears, sort of man to man, you know?
Oh, well, okay,
muttered the vaguely mollified rodent, putting its small handgun away.
But just you see that it doesn't happen again, bub.
Never, agreed Goblinhood with the sinking feeling that this was liable to be a long adventure. At that point, Mandragora came in with a pot of coffee and extra cups. She also brought some hash. Basically, though, she just wanted to catch the squirrel's act in person, not just through telepathy or precognition. Soon they were all drinking coffee and passing a little pipe around and watching the sun drip like runny egg yolk into the west. Goblinhood was also surreptitiously checking out Mandragora, who had a really nice ass. She was just like all the other black widows, except that her nice ass was here right now. She, of course, was surreptitiously monitoring these thoughts via telepathy, like an eavesdropper on a party line, seeing herself as another saw her, and liking what she saw.
Get your mind out of the gutter and back on the job,
barked the Shogun squirrel authoritatively to Goblinhood. It was no mind reader, but it did have a dirty little mind. Just what is the job? Asked G.H., blinking.
It's an important case,
gritted the little sleuth.
But it's top secret. Lose the frail.
The what? Asked G.H.
The mall. The doll. the dame, the skirt, the bimbo, the broad,
chattered the squirrel in detective lingo.
The one with the nice ass.
Listen, punk, said the Black Widow pleasantly. Don't fuck with me, okay? The others are all out playing cards or something, but I'm supposed to keep an eye on the gob to make sure he doesn't get into any more trouble out there, like he did with Oleg. Aw, gee, whined the gob. Don't worry, she told him. I'll wear a golden tarantula mask so that nobody has to know that I'm your babysitter. Just think of it as the Secret Service of your cult. As for you, squirrel, stay off my case or I'll shiver your timbers for you, matey. You got that? And there's over 2,000 of me where that came from. And don't try pulling that cheesy little heater on me either, or I'll stuff it up your funky little ass for you, okay?
Bite my crank, matey,
is what the Shogun squirrel wanted to throw at her. An old line from Captain Pissgums and his Pervert Pirates, the underground comics classic by S. Clay Wilson, from Zap Comics number 3, 1968, Apex Novelties. But under the circumstances, and not wanting to have to burst into tears again, the squirrel just muttered, "Yeah, yeah, okay." It was biding its time. The Shogun squirrel finally got tired of sticking its chin out at people and went ahead and yammered out the story. A death had occurred in the Outsiders' Quarter, Outsidersville to its residents. The death seemed a little as if it could have been sexually oriented, but nobody knew for sure. The harmlessness of it all was in serious question.
The police suspect foul play, concluded the little gumshoe.
I didn't know there were any police here, said the gob.
Well, there are, admitted the squirrel. I just said that as a figure of speech, but there is a sort of local government here composed of people who feel like doing the job, just like I feel like detecting crime.
Hell, I didn't know that either, said the gob. I must be really out of it. That's the general consensus, yes, agreed Mandragora. Anyway, the squirrel's right. Outsidersville actually has a mayor, some dwarf named Barbarossa, and a gubernatorial triumvirate, the Elephant Triad. The Shogun squirrel loudly slurped its coffee. Actually, Barbarossa was just acting mayor, while the others really were an elephant triad. One was the Victorian freak known as the Elephant Man, or a reasonable facsimile thereof. One was the female variation of the saint on the same theme, and one, the most deformed of all, was from a skeletal continuum. All had escaped to here from various alternate worlds. The Black Widow had secretly asked the elephant people to handle local politics. The Black Widows had secretly asked the elephant people to handle local political matters as much as possible to keep the gob from being overworked. And the trio also exercised a calming effect on Barbarossa by tending to make him feel lucky to just be a dwarf.
Yeah, they're the ones who assigned me to this case, boasted the vainglorious rodent.
What had actually happened was this. The Shogun squirrel had had a disappointing gambling session with Oleg, who no longer liked the squirrel, but who still didn't have anyone else to hang out with, particularly just lately. The furry loser had then dismantled its erstwhile casino in a fit of pique. Later, after consuming a number of golden tarantulas at a local bistro of the same name, the Shogun squirrel had come to its senses, shivering in a gutter with a golden tarantula hangover that just wouldn't quit. Looking for a better place to crash, the former gambling entrepreneur had broken into an abandoned warehouse. Outsidersville seemed to be lousy with them, and discovered another psionic singularity, within which was the still warm cadaver of someone who had died under suspicious circumstances. Upon reporting this to the local authorities in an important tone of voice, the squirrel had been dispatched to fetch Goblinhood, who was supposed to look into the matter.
"Normally, I'd handle the whole case myself,"
grumped the little varmint,
"but this time I just might need some help."
G.H. suddenly remembered the newspaper article that the Shogun squirrel had been brandishing earlier. "Was this death by hanging?" he asked.
"No,"
admitted the squirrel.
"It was by impalement. But since you know so much about hanging and about executions, and since the victim was one of your most devout followers, let's go on down to the Hall of Justice," decided the gob,
"or to wherever it is that this local government hangs out."
"I knew you were going to say that,"
commented Mandragora precognitively. Soon they wound up at the Golden Tarantula, in a back room, meeting with the mayor and the triad. At the squirrel's insistence, the deceptively masked Black Widow and the gob were also dressed in trench coats and snap-brim type hats.
"Look who's been out gathering nuts for the winter," snickered Barbarossa.
The squirrel started chattering something snide about the mayor of Munchkin City. To forestall any argument, the gob took his own hat off and set it down, after psionically enlarging it just a tad, over his diminutive companion, whose outraged squeaking and squalling could still be heard dimly through the chapeau. "Listen," said Goblinhood to the mayor, "lay off my partner or I'll have you recalled. The squirrel is in this thing, whether you like it or not, and I'd just as soon have the little pest where we can keep an eye on it, in any case."
"Well, okay," muttered the dwarf,
giving his gubernatorial associates an uneasy glance. The elephant triad, meanwhile, was studying Goblinhood, whom they'd heard a lot about but had never gotten around to meeting. They didn't normally put in a lot of time at the Golden Tarantula, instead frequenting a joint called Club Mastodon. Barbarossa normally held court in a sleazy little dive known as the Hole of the Mountain King. The elephant woman, who for some reason had fewer speech impediments than her counterparts and was thus usually spokesperson for the group, held her deformed hand out to the gob, saying,
"We're very pleased to meet you at last. It's such a shame, such tragedy, had to be what brought us together. If, in fact, it is tragedy."
G.H. took her hand and delivered the short, playful bow that he always offered women. He tried to introduce Mandragora, but it turned out that they already knew her. "And this, as you doubtless already know, is the Shogun Squirrel," mentioned Goblinhood, retrieving his hat, which unobtrusively shrank to fit. The Shogun squirrel was once again fondling its piece, and had been on the verge of ventilating the gob's headgear. Now it wanted a showdown.
"Slap leather, you dastard!"
it snarled at Goblinhood, falling a bit out of context as it did so. Goblinhood realized that this sort of thing could go on all night, if not forever, unless something were done about it. He also realized clearly that there was only one thing to do, and exercising the wisdom of Solomon, he did it. To everyone's amazement, he produced a gun of his own and held it to his own head. "One more word of guff out of you," he informed the little gruffian, "and I'll blow out my brains." Everyone stared at the gob while the rodent attempted to digest this information. Most of them believed that the cult leader had simply gone insane, a case of Coles to Newcastle if ever one existed. Yet G.H., though only on this case for a short time, had already detected a thing or two. First, that the government was at a loss, or it wouldn't have sent for him. Hence, this was a valid demand for everyone to get along peacefully. Second, that even the squirrel must secretly want him around, probably just as an audience for its antics, or it would have simply gone howling off to crack the case on its own. Besides, the thought of a murderer at large might have given the little rascal some pause. "Not only that," agreed Mandragora, having read the gob's mind, "but the squirrel knows that if it were responsible for your suicide, the Black Widows would be eating squirrel stew for breakfast the next day." It may have been an empty threat or not, but the squirrel started so violently at this that its little hat fell off.
"Okay, okay,"
it grumbled, replacing the Roscoe and retrieving its hat.
"I'll let it go this time."
"Did this squirrel really get written up in the newspaper back where you came from?"
whispered the elephant woman to the gob. "Word of honor," asserted G.H., disposing of his own weapon. "By the way, do you three have names?"
"Oh, sorry. John, Joan, and Jack,"
she replied, indicating the skeleton last. At which point, the skeleton clicked in a clattery sort of graveyard voice.
"I'm kind of puzzled here. Could you have actually shot yourself under the prevailing harmlessness taboo or whatever it is?"
"Yes, I could have shot myself, though I doubt if the squirrel could have shot me, since shooting myself wouldn't have harmed anybody else, though by the same token, Mandra's sisters might have had to magic up psionic squirrels for their stew. But the gauge of harmlessness is breaking down or something anyway. Besides, I'm told that our tragedy took place in a singularity."
"What's a singularity?" asked John.
"What's a gauge?"
wondered the squirrel. "A gauge," said Goblinhood, answering the questions out of order for greater clarity, "is a magic taboo or a psionic override compelling certain conditions, not unlike a curse. I think it's an old Celtic word. In this context, it prevents anyone from being hurt by someone else against their will, though it doesn't seem to extend to hurt feelings, he amended, eyeing the squirrel. A singularity, he continued, turning to the elephant man, is an energy field within which the gaze ceases to work. The first one I ever saw was the work of a Russian sci-fi hack named Pinkovsky.
But he's got an alibi for this impalement job,
blustered the squirrel self-importantly,
because he was at my casino with me while the impalement seems to have taken place.
We can't really be sure of that, murmured Joan, because none of us are trained pathologists or coroners.
Goblin Hood also wondered what the rodent's concept of time was like when it was pulling gutter duty. For one thing, it seemed to have forgotten about the colossal binge that it went on following the casino episode. But he said nothing.
There is one important clue, offered the mayor. Do the words org, rigu, og mean anything to you?
Ignoring this disturbing information for the moment, Goblin Hood made a snap decision. I think we should put the Shogun Squirrel in charge of this investigation, he said, winking broadly at everyone from behind the rodent's back so that they wouldn't all think that his mind had just snapped, since the squirrel is the best detective in town, and the one who discovered the body, after all. There was general vague agreement to this suggestion, as the Shogun Squirrel puffed itself up and began strutting pompously about. Of course, I'll go along to help with the shit work, continued G.H., which is probably what I'd be doing right now if we were all at the scene of the crime or whatever.
That's it,
snapped the squirrel, spinning around and pointing at Goblin Hood.
We'll all go to the crime scene. Pronto!
And so they did. At the warehouse, Goblin Hood studied the singularity, which couldn't be seen at all from the outside. He hadn't noticed this feature on Pinkovsky's specimen. Inside, the area of singularity was opaque, not bothering with a Martian decor this time. Goblin Hood put his hand through the wall of it, or the membrane, perhaps, remembering how flimsy the other structure had been. It's a strong field for deflecting psionics, he muttered, so it cancels the harmlessness inside the field, but the field itself is anti-psionic in nature, with only a weak invisibility spell in front to disguise it. Certain problems arose during his analysis of this phenomenon, simply underlying the fact that he didn't know enough about this technology to speak with any kind of assurance. Hence, his assumptions were all based upon educated guesswork. First of all, the field couldn't have totally canceled psionic energy entirely, or certain psionic artifacts, such as the Shogun Squirrel's detective costume, or, for that matter, the squirrel's erstwhile spacesuit, would simply have ceased to exist. Then there was the question of why he himself had been unable to psionically release himself from Pinkovsky's trap while within a similar field. The more the gob thought about this, however, the more he was inclined to attribute it to the drugs given him at that time by his captor. Treasonal aphasia regardless, his memories of the incident were clear, and now he couldn't remember even trying to break free from the Russian's restraints. He also remembered how susceptible to suggestion the Russian's drugs had left him, he concluded that that hadn't had anything to do with the singularity field. For the rest, he decided that the anti-psionic field here must be extremely specific, a matter of limited application or of relative function, and hence that its anti-psionic nature must be limited specifically to the environmental gaze, not to psionics in general. The anti-psionic field was itself, in fact, a form of psionic energy. Still, it was pretty confusing, especially when he remembered that the Black Widows hadn't been able to find him via telepathy until they were right outside the other field. For that matter, it had never occurred to him to wonder just how harmless the act of reading minds uninvited was. He supposed it didn't really count as harm, or the geish wouldn't have allowed it, but still, the hell with it. Goblin had turned to the Shogun Squirrel. "Mind telling me how you detected this?" he asked.
"Same way I led the Black Widows to you that other time," chattered the head of the investigation exuberantly. "I smelled something that I couldn't see, and of course, I pounced on the source at once."
Noting the confused-looking squirrel-shaped hole in the wall of the singularity, Goblin had suspected that the little sleuth had actually just blundered into the singularity, trying to find the smell's source so that it could accomplish said pouncing. But he took his hat off to the squirrel anyway. "I've got to hand it to you, Seamus. That snout of yours really does make you our best detective," said the gob gruffly. There followed a moment of supreme triumph and vindication for the Shogun Squirrel, as everyone on hand doubtless wished bitterly that they could be the Shogun Squirrel, Detective Nonpareil. Resolving to wear this detective outfit for the rest of its life, thus reinforcing its important public image, the squirrel gradually drifted back down from the clouds on waves of sheer egotistic euphoria. The squirrel also made a note in its mind to stop bickering with Goblinhood, if at all possible, despite the gob's many shortcomings. Monitoring the little beast's rudimentary thoughts, Mandragora burst into uncontrollable laughter, but fortunately everyone assumed that she was merely hysterical at the grisly sight of the dead man, which confronted them all within the singularity. And a grisly sight it was. Goblinhood could see right away where the sexual implications had come into it. The corpse had been classically impaled through the anus, the stake emerging just under the chin. The victim had slid down the wooden pole, which protruded for a couple of feet. Blood and excrement stained the wood at both ends. The victim was a double amputee, missing a left arm and a right leg, apparently for some time. The missing limbs had long since healed. Any psionic prostheses, however, had perished with their creator, whose body was now cold, whatever state it had been in at the point of its discovery, thanks, of course, to the time wasted by its belligerent discoverer, and, for that matter, by the rest of them. However, as Joan had pointed out, none of them were professionally trained to make much out of the forensic evidence anyway. For some reason, this dimensional continuum hadn't attracted anyone with a cop mentality. Unless you wanted to count the best detective in town. Finally, the victim had a red hourglass tattooed on his right bicep, identifying him as a particularly devout Mayan cultist. "Who was this guy?" queried Goblin Hood.
"We don't know yet," replied Joan. "There's no identification, and so far we've kept this secret from everyone except the telepathic Black Widows, to avoid panic, you know, until we can figure out for sure what happened here."
"But look at the front," advised Barbarossa, pointing to the corpse's bloody chest.
The words "Org Rigu Ag" had been carved there in the victim's flesh. "Hmm," mumbled the gob, noncommittally.
"Hey, look here,"
yapped the Shogun squirrel boisterously.
"I may have found another important clue."
It dragged in a book from somewhere outside the singularity.
"The deceased may have been reading this at the time all this took place."
"Who'd come to this dump just to read a book?"
argued Jack in a sepulchral, bony voice. The squirrel had no answer for that. Goblin Hood recognized the book as an extremely rare copy of the 2001 unexpurgated Martian edition of Abdul Alhazred's infamous Necronomicon, in an English translation, almost totally unavailable in most continua. But he, of course, possessed a gilded and jewel-encrusted copy back at the palace library, given him by a Black Widow who, oh, forget it. This was obviously a different copy, no gold, no jewels. Its spine was cracked so that it fell open at a specific place. Silently, he read,
"And it shall come to pass at the end of times, when the stars are right, that the great old ones shall come forth once again from their haunts, to wreak their havoc with all things, and to sow madness and destruction in the minds of men. And then shall great Cthulhu rise once again from his sunken sleep, yea, from his dread corpse city of Rilia. Shall he rise again to dominate mankind, and Yog-Sothoth, the gate, shall open unto the elder hordes this world, oozing out gloat from the places between time, space, and time. And Nyarlathotep, the mighty messenger, shall walk once more among men and in the guise of man, and his coming shall be the harbinger to these dread times. Yah Shub-Niggurath, the black goat of the woods with 1,000 young, and she too shall stride forth among the multitudes of men, leaving horror in her wake and in that of her young. And all shall come in the name of Azathoth, the demon sultan, that monstrous nuclear chaos, that eldritch horror of horrors, the blind idiot god that writhes and gnaws and foams and blasphemes at the center of everything to the muffled, maddened beat of vile drums and the thin, monotonous whine of accursed flutes. And even now are the old ones at hand, though ye see them not. As a foulness shall ye know them when they be among ye, save one who may not be known, save only Atlak Naka, whom some say is the mother of all, yea, even of that blind idiot chaos, which is Azathoth. And ye know her not, for apart she dwells from the other gods and mankind alike. Dream weaver that she is yet caught in her own web, lost in her work of eternal spinning. Yet in that final war shall she come forth at last to claim her own.
Rubbish, muttered Goblin Hood, putting the book down. It reminded him of St. Cloud's literary ravings, the novel G.H. had had to finish, ghostwriting for his late friend. And thinking about St. Cloud caused the gob to think about St. Cloud's treasonal addiction. The drug had evidently affected St. Cloud a bit differently than it did most people. At least Goblin Hood had never experienced that weird state of mind in which St. Cloud had sat around talking to himself and believing that he was closer to or enjoying some near-perfect communion with God. And for all his own universalism, at times like this, Goblin Hood felt sort of cheated by the lack. Joan's voice brought him out of his reverie.
Do you think this could have been self-inflicted?
No. Or at least, it could only have been accomplished with help, or else psionically, and then only by a suicide who was largely anesthetized, or else willing to embrace excruciating and prolonged pain. And whoever else may have done it, our presumptive perp must either have had help or block and tackle or the strength of several people, psionic or otherwise, mumbled the gob, starting to get a bad headache.
When the going gets tough, the tough get going,
ejaculated the Shogun Squirrel, apropos of nothing at all. Now everybody started getting a headache. Later, the gob sat in his library, wondering about the whole thing and staring off into space, feeling more alone than ever before, and wishing that he could be truly alone for just a while without the omnipresent telepathic weight of thousands of relatively identical black widows hovering in the back of his mind. Sometimes they got to be just a bit much, reminding him a little of the fish speakers from Frank Herbert's God Emperor of Dune, a bunch of early birds who caught the biggest worm around. On the other hand, he always had nice company, even if he got sort of pissed off at one widow, which almost never happened. It didn't affect his relations with the others. But the loneliness that he felt now transcended that obsessive, semi-narcissistic passion, proving apparently that great sex and loving emotional compatibility aren't necessarily everything. As it happened, in any case, he couldn't sense any of the BWs in his head right now, which might not have meant anything, or perhaps they were aware of his current need for privacy and were respecting that by leaving him alone. Something was really getting the gob down, and had only peripherally involved, and it only peripherally involved the mysterious recent impalement, which in any case, in any event, had been tabled by most of the befuddled ad hoc investigative committee after a certain amount of skullduggery or jiggery-pokery regarding a death certificate. The meat wagon had been called and the bigwigs had all returned to their usual haunts, as witness goblinhood now, except for the Shogun Squirrel, who had loitered at the crime scene sniffing around after more clues. Dimly, goblinhood hoped that the feisty little sleuth would crack the case wide open. It would make a good spiderweb headline. Long arm of the squirrel strikes again. But the problem, as G.H. saw it, was this. That solving the mystery would simply amount to a bigger, nastier can of worms being opened up for everybody. And a nastier can of worms than the Shogun Squirrel itself was hard to imagine, or seemed so anyway. Actually, Goblinhood knew that things could get a lot worse, and even that they probably would. The presumed murder itself, though certainly tragic and horrible, was small next to its implications. The entire psionic fabric of things was being subjected to assault or other stress, or was, for whatever reasons, simply in the process of breaking down. He had no idea how far the disintegration might be able to go, but he feared the worst. And a more personal element was also bothering him. Earlier, he'd envied St. Cloud's heartfelt religious obsession or mania, and yet that envy itself was sort of interesting in that he'd never felt it before. This implied that his usual mindset here in Sodom did, in fact, partake somewhat of St. Cloud's spiritual convictions, perhaps to an extent noticeable only in its lack. Perhaps, for that matter, the whole idea of harmlessness was somehow inextricably bound up with the concept of a benevolent deity. Worst of all, the process of breakdown affecting the gaze of harmlessness or the psionic field maintaining it seemed natural in some way, or possibly so anyway, in his mind, given his lack of knowledge about the field itself. Without knowing more, he felt that taking action, such as the reinforcement of the already existing psionic field, might itself be unintentionally less than harmless. And yet, could murder by impalement ever even possibly be something not to oppose? It was all a pretty problem, especially when he tried to imagine explaining it at a loss for eloquence to the best detective in town, which dignitary would surely wish to know, after things had finished falling apart just why Goblinhood had sat around with his fingers up his ass and let this happen. One of the best of all stories ever written about alternate universes was All the Myriad Ways by Larry Niven, first published in 1968. This story also centered around detective work, but that wasn't why G.H. decided to read it now. Instead, he read it to strengthen his own belief in the very concept of alternate worlds. Belief he'd found is at the very core of psionic efficiency, and in case this whole harmless dimension he was in did turn out to be some sort of a big trap, he wanted to at least have a chance of being able to cut and run. Unfortunately, Niven's story dealt with pointless murders and suicides, which seriously depressed the gob to read about. This, on top of all the other current stress, succeeded in disturbing the balance of his mind, just enough so that he removed his weapon from its shoulder holster, put the gun to his head, said aloud, "At least the Shogun Squirrel won't have to take this rap, and I won't have to take any more crap from the squirrel," and blew out his brains. Sadly, his death, rather his absence in the near future, resulted in the destruction of the entire alternate reality continuum. The end. But across the hinge, Goblinhood never got around to reading the story. Instead, his attention was captured by Mandragora, who came into the library to tell him her theory about the murder. Simply put, Mandragora's theory was that G.H. was still being haunted and subtly opposed by his old Martian enemy and nemesis, the quasi-demonic Nurgle. "Look at those Martian and Lovecraftian clues," she told him, in support of this notion. "The fucker's actually toying with you." She was unclear, however, on just what action G.H. should take. Mandragora's lack of constructive suggestions on this point was nothing new to Goblinhood, though it was unfortunate, since he could have used a few positive suggestions right about then. But he'd been all through this before, ever since he'd gotten mixed up with the Martian entity back in 1986. The big question was, how did he fight something that seemed to thrive on negative energy? The harmless Martian sigil emblazoned on the gob's forehead had seemed to work well enough so far, if not being particularly positive, then at least keeping him from using his psionic ability to do anything negative, which could have been exploited by the seemingly nefarious Martian Zoni. But perhaps Nurgle was still around, although kept at bay up until now. And perhaps Nurgle, by finding some method of circumventing Sodom's harmlessness gauge, or by inspiring Penkovsky, for instance, to do so, was now once again attacking the gob by trying to tempt him into not wanting to be harmless anymore, into abandoning his own gaze in the name of vengeance or whatever. It would have been so simple, for example, with things being the way they were now in Sodom, to simply override the harmless power of the sigil, thus corrupting and negating it for good, and to psionically decree that the impalement murderer, if there was one, should come to a bad end. The execution of justice was, after all, part of his job here, or at least it seemed to come with the territory. for that matter, maybe Nurgle had somehow contrived to entice him to come here in the first place and get stuck in this position where he'd have to make decisions about things like that. On the other hand, he'd never really known what the Martian's true motives were, nor for that matter had he ever physically been able to detect or prove the presence of Nurgle. His only evidence of Nurgle's involvement now, for instance, were a small handful of Martianoid clues, which in Goblinhood's admittedly confused opinion smacked of being red herrings. At any rate, the gob heard Mandragora out and started out thinking that hers was a crackpot theory, but he wound up devoting enough time and energy to it that his distraction from other matters unfortunately led to the destruction of the entire alternate reality continuum. The end. But across the hinge, Mandragora came in and announced, "Company's coming soon." "Fuck 'em," mumbled the gob. "I'm going to bed." "I knew you were going to say that," she replied. "And yes, I'll come with you." Later, as they lay in bed smoking together, she said, "I really like that article you're going to write for the paper next week about that dream you're going to have." "Don't tell me," he yelped. "Geez, you precogs." This article wasn't a profile in Carnage, but was instead a short story of sorts. Here it is. Prologue. For what it's worth, the following dream took place shortly after I'd read an article about dreams in a science text. However accurately, the article claimed that if you don't wake up within about 10 minutes of a dream, you won't remember it. Family matters, or fools die on the launch pad, with apologies to Mario Puzo. Part 1. Afternoon. Joshua. It was afternoon, a fine fall day in early November. It was cool and crisp. Orange and brown leaves were falling all over the backyard, where I was helping an old man putter and tinker with cars. The old man's young grandchild was there as well, scrambling about and trying to help. There were at least two cars being messed around with. One was an old DeSoto, circa 1959, and the other a considerably newer car. We seemed to be moving parts from one to the other of these rather absurdly and inexplicably. For some reason, I was reminded of seedy defense contractors building a dubious joke of a rocket ship for NASA and the Pentagon. When I'm awake, by the way, cars bore the living hell out of me. Somewhere in through here, the grandchild lost an important car part or something, causing a very minor row, a tempest in a teapot, actually, which after a few crusty old manisms, a few childish tears, and a few conciliatory words from me, happily came to nothing. The energetic little scamp was in and out of both cars most of the time, capering merrily about, generally getting in the way, but still having a jolly, grandfatherly sort of an afternoon with the old man, who bore the fun as well as he could. I found time to think about how nice it was for these two to be spending a little time together. The old man was getting on in years, and I knew that he wouldn't get to spend much time on active duty as a grandfather before old age carried him away. I guess that I went into a brown study of some sort then, and fell to pondering family relationships in general. This led me into a consideration of the most famous case of child abuse and neglect in the Bible, the story of Joshua. Actually, in my waking mind, I know very little about his story. In my dream, though, it seems that Joshua was one of those kids who got extremely kicked around by members of his family, like Joseph, I think. Eventually, I guess he even got sold into slavery, and yet he went on to order the sun to halt in its progress around the earth during the famous Battle of Jericho. I believe that last bit is according to real scripture. Whatever the real story was, this dream version asserted ex cathedra, as it were, somehow impressed me a lot. Local boy makes good, I more or less thought, and then I began mentally humming the old familiar tune, Joshua fit the Battle of Jericho, 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 Part 2, Night. This message brought to you by Jericho, Jerry, huh? Looks like a segue here. I guess a lot of time must have passed while I was in the brown study. In any event, the afternoon had passed away, and I suppose the old man did too, or at least he went away. Now it was late at night, and it might have been a million years later. I was in an enormous room whose entire floor was one huge mattress. On a nearby television screen flickered a late-night movie hosted by an owl in sunglasses. For some reason, though, it seemed more like an afternoon-type movie. Surrounding me on the gargantuan mattress was a huge throng of women, a group that I have since come to think of as the Sisterhood Union. This mob included virtually every woman that I've ever been in love with or seriously cared about. It was sort of like a gigantic group marriage. They were all married to each other, and I was there as a kind of mascot. In my dream, they all got along famously with one another, and they sort of tolerated me collectively and liked me to one extent or another as individuals. I don't know if any of them were ever in love with me or not, but they were all capable of treating me with warmth and compassion. Quite a few of them seemed to be in love with each other. If I had any children with this bunch, I suppose that they were all safely tucked away in some huge nursery room or something. The Sisterhood Union sort of scared me, if only because there were so many of them, but they also inspired me with awe. I regarded them as angelic beings, near godlike, compared to the shabby likes of me. At any given time, there were usually a few of them who were more willing to put up with me than the others, and with these I tended to spend most of my time, wearing out my welcome, as it were, until it was time to find renewed sympathy with others. I was with two of the more indulgent ones now, near the TV screen. They were a heartbreakingly beautiful pair, whose names were Samothrace and Saint Hawk. Their general attitude toward me was one of genial patronage, though they both often tried to persuade me to quit smoking cigarettes, for both were dedicated non-smokers. Oddly, more than half the women in the room, including these two, were wearing identical bright orange t-shirts, bearing some type of printed, four-cornered motif. This symbol appeared to combine something about physics, super string theory in particular, with whatever the good side is to drug abuse. It turned out that they had all been, that afternoon, to a special one-time-only community festival which had been organized to celebrate the birth or death, or advent anyway, of some major counterculture figure. St. Hawk described this person as a great super genius, sort of a cross between Albert Einstein and Janis Joplin. It was all pretty confusing, so I soon found my attention wandering to the movie that was on television. The film's plot gradually became clear. Unethical defense contractors were building unsafe space vehicles with shoddy substandard parts and endangering lives. At the end, during the launch, the rocket got saved.